Phoebe Inner versus Martin.
Good morning, Your Honors.
Good morning, Mr. Mann. Will you speak with us, please?
And may I begin? I'm sorry.
Yes.
Okay.
Like I said, may you please speak with us.
Okay. Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Jonathan Mann of Law Offices of Robin Bresky on behalf of the appellant, Joanna Vibe Enner. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal. As the court is aware, this is an appeal of the district court order dismissing Ms. Enner's suit pursuant to the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. I think the parties agree on the standard that the dismissal of a civil action on fugitive disentitlement grounds requires that the plaintiff is a fugitive, that his fugitive status has a connection to the civil action, and that the sanction of dismissal is necessary to effectuate the concerns underlying the doctrine. And we respectfully submit to the court that in the present case, the district court abused its discretion in dismissing the center's suit. So
if your client came back to Florida, she'd be arrested, wouldn't she? Because the police could act on the referral to law enforcement that was issued by the family court after it found her in contempt and in violation of its anti-stalking injunction.
I think that she could be arrested, Your Honor. She's
subject to arrest.
She's subject to arrest. The order of referral to law enforcement that was issued on, I believe it's October 31st, 2017, is something that the district court struggled with, because that order,
if it permits her arrest and she knows about it, it's hard for me to see how she's not a fugitive, as she remains in another country.
Our position is that, I mean, she certainly has been found to be in contempt of the family court orders. Those orders are what they are, and they speak for themselves.
Well, let me stop you there for a second. I'm sorry, but what is there in the record about the state court finding her in indirect criminal contempt? I know the state court issued a show cause order. When did it issue an order finding her in indirect criminal contempt, if at all? Did that happen?
I believe the answer is no, Your Honor, that she was not found to be in indirect criminal contempt. There's an order granting the motion for contempt, and that was July 18th of 2017. Then there's the subsequent order of referral to law enforcement on October 31st, 2017.
And there's an order to show cause why she shouldn't be held in indirect criminal contempt, right? But I might be mistaken, but I did not see, and it may not be necessary. I mean, your opponent might be right on this, but as a matter of just historical fact, do we have an order from the state court holding your client in indirect criminal contempt?
I believe the answer is no.
That's what I thought from my reading of the record. It may not be necessary, but I thought that there was no order from the state court holding her in indirect criminal contempt. Okay, I'll ask Mr. Hyacin the same thing. That was my understanding.
Counsel, let me come at the question this way. We know that in order to apply the fugitive disentitlement doctrine, three things have to be established. The district court said they were. The first was that the plaintiff is in fact a fugitive. You say the district court was wrong for two reasons. One, she lacked the intent necessary. And two, no bench warrant or arrest warrant had been issued in the case. The district court found she constructively fled from the Florida Family Court. The district court referenced the fact that on multiple occasions, she ignored the state court orders and took her children abroad, and reached the conclusion that she had absconded. Is that a finding of fact, or is that a mixed question of law and fact? I asked the question because it seemed to me, under the circumstances of this case, that was essentially a fact-bound question. And if that's right, we would only review it for clear error. And so I'm asking, A, is that right? And B, if so, where's the clear error in the district court finding?
I believe that Your Honor's correct that would be a factual finding. That's a factual finding that was made by the district court entirely based on the state court orders that were in the record. The order of dismissal came about following a status conference in the district court. The hearing was only noticed for a status conference, and Ms. Enner was not ordered to be at that hearing. Why is that relevant? Well, because in cases such as Pessin versus Rodriguez, which was relied on by the appellees and relied on heavily by the district court, and other cases on this topic of fugitive disentitlement doctrine, you have a finding.
What you've got to show me is that the district court's determination, conceding that it was a fact finding, at least under these circumstances, that there was clear error. Wasn't there a fair amount of evidence that supported the district court determination that Enner was in fact a fugitive, including, among other things, looking at the state court record and her failure to comply with a series of state court requirements, including presence, participation in hearings, her absence, are taking the kids and going abroad, whether to England or Finland or somewhere else? Why couldn't the judge find as a fact that Enner was a fugitive?
I believe that the characterization that she's a fugitive is a legal determination that's not met here. That would be my position, Your Honor, that the findings that she had violated these state court orders are factual, but the characterization that Ms. Enner is a fugitive for the purposes of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine is a legal conclusion.
Whether someone fled from a jurisdiction of a court is certainly a fact-based question, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor, I would agree with that.
Well, determinations of fugitive status can also exist ex post, right? So you can flee the jurisdiction at a time when you are not maybe necessarily prohibited from going elsewhere, but then you can be found to be a fugitive if the court issues some sort of order or process and you don't return. That's at least my understanding of our cases. Why isn't that scenario met here? In other words, she may not have been a fugitive when she initially left with the children for England or other parts. But given the number of orders issued afterwards, the orders finding that she's in violation, the orders saying that she's engaging in contemptuous type conduct, the orders referring her to law enforcement, why doesn't all of that as a mix support the district court's decision on fugitive status?
And that is what happened here factually, Your Honor, in terms of she leaves June 1st, 2017. At that point, there's no order of contempt, let alone order of referral to law enforcement. Those come later after she already had left the jurisdiction. But I think the answer to Your Honor's question lies again in that the conclusion that she's a fugitive for purposes of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine is a legal conclusion, the application of which arises out of situations where you have a criminal defendant who flees and then appeals their criminal you have a conviction in a criminal case, criminal defendant flees, you have a direct appeal. That's the classic case. And when we're talking about trying to apply that to a case where we have a family law litigant who's found in contempt, and we do not have a bench warrant for an arrest, we have an order of referral to law enforcement, which the operative paragraph of which says it's referring the case to law enforcement to investigate respondent's acts.
But you've conceded that it makes her subject to arrest, that based on that referral, she can be arrested.
Honestly, in other words, law enforcement could arrest her based on that referral. Right. I thought your better argument would be that although that is a possibility, there's been no court order mandating her arrest. There's no warrant or arrest warrant per se. And you seem to suggest in your brief that that is a prerequisite.
Right. I wouldn't say that it's necessarily a prerequisite, but in this case where you do not have that, our position is that she could not legally be deemed a fugitive for purposes of the doctrine.
Let me ask just one very quick question. The second element is that Anna's fugitive status has a connection to the civil action. Did you interpose any objection in your blue brief to that? Did you raise it in your blue brief?
We did not specifically raise that in our...
Why isn't that the end of it? Why ought we to review that claim when it only came up for the first time in reply?
I can only say that the two questions are intertwined to some extent as to whether or not she's a fugitive.
Well, I grant you that, but this element is different. Whether fugitive status, assuming arguendo the evidence supported that finding, has a connection to the civil action. That requires a judge to make an examination of the state civil action and see whether there's a connection. The judge did that. And when I read the blue brief, I did not see any objection or quarrel with that determination. Am I right about that?
That's accurate, Your Honor, yes.
Thank you.
I did not draft the brief. I'm confined to arguing it, but.
Thanks very much.
Okay, Mr. Mann, you saved 4 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Hyacin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. This is Scott Hyacin. I'm the attorney representing the appellee, Mr. Martin, in this. My name is Scott Hyacin. I'm representing the appellee, Mr. Martin, in this matter. And I'd just like to begin at the beginning, which is, as opposing counsel said, June 1st, 2017, which is the date that the appellant has admitted that she fled the jurisdiction. She absconded from the jurisdiction with two minor children that she shares with my client, Mr. Martin. And she has never returned to this jurisdiction. And she had not returned to this jurisdiction by the time that she had filed this federal lawsuit in 2019. And she has not returned to this jurisdiction today.
When was this lawsuit filed?
April of 2019. And I think what's important, and I think the court has highlighted this in the prior argument, is what was before the district court at the time it ruled motion to dismiss based on the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. And those are the facts that were before the court, that this appellant had fled the jurisdiction. Her flight and her conduct before and after her flight violated, I believe, as the state court said, virtually every court order entered by the state court. And based on that conduct, the court entered a civil contempt order. The court entered a referral to law enforcement that, it should be noted, it is undisputed by the appellant and by the parties that the appellant is subject to arrest based on the language of that order. in page.
That's the same thing, Mr. Hyacin, as actually issuing an arrest warrant. Or put more artfully, was there any requirement on the part of the state family court judge to issue a warrant of arrest, having A, already found civil contempt, and B, referred it to law enforcement? Did she have to go to the third step and say, here's an arrest warrant, I'm signing it?
For purposes of the Fugitive Disentitlement Doctrine, no. And I believe if the Barnett case, I think, is helpful in this, where this court found that the two parties in Barnett were fugitives from both a contempt order and the arrest warrant. There's no authority that has been cited by appellant, and none that I have seen, that say that an arrest warrant is a condition precedent to the Fugitive Disentitlement Doctrine. What the law says is that in a civil action where the plaintiff is in violation of court orders and evading arrest. And in this instance, it is uncontested that the appellant will be subject to arrest based on the law enforcement referral, as she stated in her statement of facts, irrespective of perhaps what the argument was earlier today. And it is essentially uncontested that her staying away from the state of Florida conduct that is evading arrest, as Judge Jordan pointed out. Even though the contempt orders and the order to show cause and the law enforcement referral were all were entered after her flight, as the Barnett case shows and as Pessin relied on, that the court can infer from their absence that a fugitive is intending to stay away or staying in hiding to avoid an ex post.
Let me put the question this way. Let's suppose the Immigration Service learned that she was about to get on a plane and fly from London Heathrow to Miami International Airport. And they turned that information over to Metro-Dade Sheriff. And the sheriff went to the airport, met her when she came in and arrested her. Would he be free to do that? Would that be a lawful arrest based on the preface you've described?
Based on the court orders entered in this case that are in the record, yes. I believe that would be a valid arrest that would satisfy the Fourth Amendment.
Well, and your opponent hasn't contested that, as I understand it.
Correct. And as I said,
as I understand it, your opponent's argument is that law enforcement wouldn't be required to arrest her, but it could arrest her.
That appears to be the argument made, in oral argument here. I'm not sure that was really articulated in the brief, but as I said, when you look at the brief says, and I can quote it here, the referral of law enforcement authorized any Florida law enforcement officer to detain Ener if located in the jurisdiction. That's from the statement of facts of the appellant.
That's on page 6 of the blue brief.
Correct. So it's undisputed from the appellant that the effect of that order would be that she could be detained anytime that law enforcement finds her.
Now, Mr. Hyacin, let me ask you a question. Most of our cases under the doctrine involve dismissal of an appeal or of a district court action in and of itself because of the application of the Fugitive Disentitlement Doctrine. We have very few cases dealing with the effect of flight and fugitive status in one case requiring dismissal in a second case. But we do have one case called FDIC versus Farrow from 1999. The citation is 178 F3rd 1159. That's a published case in which an individual was charged by indictment in the Southern District of Florida with a number of crimes related to bank fraud and wire fraud. The person was in Saudi Arabia, did not come back, was deemed to be a fugitive. But the case that was at issue was not that case, but a civil case filed by the FDIC against the same individual seeking millions of dollars in damages based on that same type of conduct, the breach of fiduciary duty, common law fraud, wire fraud, etc. The district court found that the fugitive disentitlement doctrine applied to the civil case and basically did not let that fugitive defendant defend the civil case brought by the FDIC. We reversed. Now, we made a point of saying that was a case in which the fugitive was a defendant in a civil case that he didn't file, but we nevertheless said that the doctrine was inapplicable and should not be used in that circumstance to prevent an avowed fugitive from defending a related civil suit. How do you distinguish that case from this one? Is it only the fact that Ms. Viva Enner is a plaintiff in the suit against Mr. Martin?
That is the, in my view, that's the significant distinction. Yes, because the principle that the fugitive disentitlement doctrine is trying to supports this doctrine.
Well, isn't there something more here? I mean, it seems to me that Ms. Fibener is attacking the family court proceedings from which she is a fugitive. It's not just that she's a plaintiff. It's that she's attacking the very proceedings that she's trying to evade.
That's correct, Your Honor. And there, I think there's two issues going on here. Is that in the test for when the fugitive disentitlement doctrine is applicable, the second element is a connection between the plaintiff's the underlying lawsuit and the fugitive status, and particularly here. The plaintiff is basically waging a collateral attack on the state court and the state court judgments and the settlement agreement that forms the state court judgments through the district court, and I think that makes it a very distinguishable from the FDIC case and the fact that the principle that is animating this doctrine is that a fugitive can't come to court and get the benefits of court and then simultaneously. Basically offend the dignity of the court by being a fugitive at the same time. Now, in the FDIC case, there was no attempt to get affirmative relief from the court. It was being applied to prevent someone from defending themselves against a civil action. If there had been a lawsuit by Mr. Ferrone against the federal government, a debt claim, for instance, to prevent the FDIC from doing what it wanted to do, I think that case would have been analyzed differently. Because the idea is that a party can't thumb its nose at the court system and then simultaneously seek affirmative relief from it. I think there's a U.S. Supreme Court case called Deegan that also talks about if it's in a defensive position, it's distinguishable for purposes of the doctrine.
Okay.
And to get back to the Judge Marcus, you asked about the idea of there's a connection. What is the connection between the underlying litigation in state court and the lawsuit that was before Judge Ruiz when he dismissed it? And if you look at the allegations in the complaint, most of the allegations are basically attempts to relitigate issues that were in state court. She specifically alleges, for instance, violations or breaches rather of the settlement agreement that is within the jurisdiction of the family court. And in fact, there's a specific allegation that the appellant alleges in the complaint that she was forced to flee the United States because of the unfair litigation practices of Mr. Martin. So she in her complaint, she literally tries to recast her fugitive status in some defensive way, she was compelled to leave the jurisdiction because of the nasty behavior of Mr. Martin's lawyers, if you were to believe it, and that forms the basis of an abuse of process claim and a conspiracy claim in her complaint. So, to the extent that there is a challenge to the connection nexus prong of the.
The prefatory question is whether or not that's even before us. As I understood it, and as your colleague agreed quite candidly, no objection was made in the blue brief to the determination by the trial court that Enner's fugitive status indeed had a connection to the civil action. He never really objected, certainly not in the blue brief.
That
obliged to put you on notice before you filed a response to that. So I guess what I'm asking is, do I even have to examine whether the district court got it right? It may not be a hard question going to the merits, but is that properly even before me?
It is not properly before this court. In fact, the only issue raised in before the district court in the response to the motion to dismiss was a challenge to the fugitive status prong of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine. And in fact, the argument that was raised before the district court as to that prong is not the argument that was raised in the brief or an oral argument. That argument was based purely on the notion of intent to flee having to be established, which is the point that Judge Jordan was referring to about that intent to flee can be found after the fact. If in fact the party declines to return after there's a contempt order, an order for arrest is entered.
He did address the third prong, whether dismissal was necessary to effect the concerns of this equitable doctrine. And in that regard, what he says essentially is that the dismissal was too blunt an instrument to use here, and that it impaired her due process rights. Do you want to address that for a moment?
Yes, thank you. The principles, again, that the purposes of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine are, among other things, are to preserve the dignity of the court, to address the difficulty in enforcing judgments, promote the efficient operation of the courts, and discourage flight from justice, and to avoid prejudice to the party, and to avoid the inequity of allowing a fugitive to basically reap the benefits of court without the justice system without honoring adverse rulings. And Judge Ruiz, in his order, specifically found the latter two, that it would be inequitable to allow this fugitive, who's again has been at that time had been on the lam for about 2 years with Mr. Martin's daughters, to come to court and seek relief, and then without any expectation that she would actually abide by any court orders. And as evidence of that, among other things, Judge Ruiz noted that when there was the status conference that was set, the district court communicated with the appellant. The appellant had called Chambers to set up a telephone conference from parts unknown. She has asserted she's in England, but there's really no evidence of that, but that's true. And she had said she was intended to appear at that hearing, and then she didn't appear. Okay. And in the court's order, the court relied in part on that as evidence that there's no real effort to appear on her part. And I'm sorry.
Your time has expired, Mr. Hyacin, we understand your argument. Mr. Mann, you've saved 4 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll address what was being discussed just most recently regarding the Ms. Enner not appearing at the status conference by telephone. I think I would say that she was not ordered to appear, and that's a distinguishing factor that we have from cases like Pessin, cases like, I believe it's Barnett, where, for instance, in Pessin, you have the trial, the father files an ICARA petition to have the children returned to him in Venezuela. Court grants the petition, orders the children returned. The mother fails to comply. The court then sets two different conferences at which the mother specifically ordered to attend, and then the mother does not attend. And so the court says, you know, we have a contempt order. Court finds the mother in contempt, and the court issues an arrest warrant, which again is different than what we have in the instant case, where Ms. Enner is not in violation of any of the orders of the district court. The Judge Ruiz discussed in the transcript at the status conference, he said, you know, I considered, to paraphrase, he said, I considered ordering that Ms. Enner appear before the court physically in person within 10 days. And I decided not to do that because the appellees were trying to move quickly on this dismissal motion.
But isn't the critical, and I understand your position on that. I agree with you. I don't think she violated any direct order of Judge Ruiz's in this case. But isn't the real question whether or not she violated the state court orders to such a degree that she was held in contempt and that law enforcement was authorized to arrest her? Isn't that the critical question?
I think that the legal question goes further than what Your Honor just stated. As I tried to explain earlier, that we're talking about application of the fugitive disentitlement doctrine, our position is that what the district court did in this case represents an extension of that doctrine, to where you have the state court findings, as Your Honor's discussed, but that here we have the district court in which Ms. Enner has not violated any of the court's orders, and the district court solely basing its findings on what happened in the state court. And
why couldn't the judge do just that? Why couldn't the district judge, in making the determination about whether or not she was a fugitive, focus on her conduct before the state court and the orders that the state court had entered, holding aside completely her failure to appear in the federal case?
I would point out that she was it was only a status conference, and she was not ordered to appear before the district court. There was no evidentiary.
She specifically requested to participate telephonically and then failed to do so, didn't she?
That's correct, Your Honor.
She engaged in, it seems to me, the same kind of gamesmanship that she had been engaging in the state courts. Or at least that Judge Ruiz could certainly have thought that's where this is going. But that gets back to Judge Marcus's question. I mean, he could just look at what she did in the state court, couldn't he?
I believe that he could. But as I said, legally.
Couldn't he, counsel, infer the requisite intent from the events that he saw in the state court? And that's a fact question.
That's a fact question, but again, our position is that it's a legal question to label her a fugitive, and that was not met here.
Okay. I think we understand your case, Mr. Hyacin. We'll move to the next one this morning.